think about the last time you had to cancel a subscription. There's probably some waiting on hold, some guessing at your password, some mind-numbing small talk. And maybe, after all of that, you still weren't able to cancel it. Good news, it doesn't have to be this way, thanks to Rocket Money. Rocket Money tracks, manages, and can cancel your subscriptions for you. When you connect your accounts, you'll see a complete picture of all of your recurring subscriptions all in one place. Rocket Money organizes your subscriptions by due date and notifies you when something is coming up, so you'll never be caught off guard when you get charged. If you see a subscription you want to cancel, Rocket Money simplifies the process. Instead of waiting on hold for an hour, you can cancel it right from the app. Rocket Money will even try to get you a refund for the money you spent on subscriptions you forgot about. Stop wasting time trying to cancel subscriptions the hard way. Make your life easier and go to rocketmoney.com/cancel. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel, or download the app from the Apple App or Google Play Stores.
Coda just made riding the bus easier than ever. Now you can pay your Coda fare by tapping your smartphone, smartwatch, or card, just like you do at the coffee shop or grocery store. Love paying with smart card? Keep doing that. Have a pass? Still works perfectly. Want to tap your phone? Now you can do that too. It's just one more way to move your way with Coda. Get moving now with Tap to Pay. Learn more at coda.com/tap.
Hey everybody, this is Sunny Bunch. I am joining you with a very special episode of The Bulwark Goes to Hollywood today. It's my new podcast over at The Bulwark. I hope you're listening, and if not, you should check it out and subscribe to it. But it's kind of an Across the Movie Aisle reunion. I figured we would you might enjoy giving it a listen. So we're still trying to figure out how to bring the show back. It might be on hiatus, frankly, until movies come back in a real way, in a real proper way in the movie theaters. But we'll see. Until then, enjoy this episode of the show. Please subscribe to The Bulwark Goes to Hollywood if you haven't already. It's a fun little interview podcast I do. It's on major podcast networks everywhere. I think it's even on Stitcher for all you Stitcher weirdos. So check it out. Please enjoy this episode. We are trying to figure out how to bring the show back. Hopefully it will come back soon. And I'll see you guys soon. Welcome back to The Bulwark Goes to Hollywood. I am Sunny Bunch, culture editor at The Bulwark. I am very excited to be joined by my good friends, Alyssa Rosenberg, who is very tired and also a Washington Post opinion columnist, and Peter the Man Suderman. He wrote this in GChat, just so you know. He's Peter the Man Suderman, Reason Magazine features editor.
I am also very tired.
I am very excited to be joined by my friends. Some of you will have been listeners to Across the Movie Aisle, which, you know, the once in future podcast, hopefully, that you knew and loved. I wanted to have them on today so we could talk about A, the state of things post the election, but B, also just kind of how everything in the movie industry looks right now and what we can kind of expect from coverage of the movie industry going forward. So thanks for joining me on the show
today,
guys.
Thanks for having us.
Glad to be here.
So one thing that came up this week, and I found deeply distressing as both a fan of the movies and a fan of Christopher Nolan, was Christopher Nolan in an interview with the Los Angeles Times tied to a new book of criticism about his movies. He suggested that Hollywood is taking the wrong lessons from the box office results of Tenet, which, as longtime listeners of this show know, we're not great domestically. I think it's at $55 million or something like that right now domestically. Probably won't do much more than that, but did better overseas. It's around $350 million total worldwide gross. His argument is that we should be looking at the success of the film in foreign markets like China and some other places, instead of focusing on the failure of the domestic box office. And I find this a little bit troubling for a couple of reasons. One is that, A, we should not abandon the domestic box office. The domestic box office is very important. But also, B, it's important because if we focus on the sorts of movies that play very, very well overseas, what you're looking at is an endless stream of Fast and Furious, Marvel, MCU, type movie, right?
Transformers
You're looking
films,
at the big
Michael Bay's
Transformers
greatest
films.
Contributions to society.
The 11 million Avatar movies that are coming down the pike in our direction.
Right. So if you focus more on the foreign box office out of the Hollywood product, right? The Hollywood product is going to be the sort of things that critics in general do not really care for. Now, maybe we're bad people and we deserve what we get, and we'll come to that later. But I do think that this is actually like a kind of a it's a worrying signal to me if even Christopher Nolan is like, let's focus on the big budget stuff that does well in China, because that's not a future of movies that I'm super excited about.
Yeah, I think that if there is one kind of bipartisan concern in the culture wars right now, it's the sort of tilting of influence on Hollywood towards not even specifically what Chinese audiences want, but what Chinese censors are willing to let them watch from abroad. And I think there are a couple of things going on here. I mean, I think Nolan was really desperate to save the American box office. There was a reason that he was pushing for Tenet to open on big screens instead of going to video on demand. And, you know, for good reason, they had sunk a lot of money into promoting the movie. And, you know, the math was just not going to be good if they went to video on demand, as we saw with the sort of talk about whether the new James Bond movie would go in that direction. So there is the fact that Nolan, I think, failed in his efforts to convince Americans en masse that it was safe to go back to the movies. There is the increasing attention to the Chinese box office, which is something that's been going on for a while now and is accelerating in part because their COVID-19 outbreak is more under control than ours and their movie theaters are open. And so it is a market that exists and is viable. And just the sort of blockbusterization of Hollywood cinema, which has been going on, that's not a new phenomenon. And so it's hard to disentangle these things. But I think that, you know, at rock bottom, you have to convince people that it's safe to go back to movie theaters. That is not happening in the United States. And until that happens, sort of appealing to patriotism and American values is not going to do that much against the power of an open movie market anywhere. So I think, you know, these things are all tangled up in each other. I don't know how to separate them. I don't know how to sort of get beyond them. But it's not great.
Peter?
I mean, if you only focus on movies that are going to play internationally, which mostly means China, because China is by far the biggest international market, then it's not just going to change movies in the way that Alyssa is talking about, though it certainly will. It's not just going to mean that movies will end up being designed for Chinese censors and Chinese viewer tastes. It's also going to change the types of movies that can be financed. Because if you assume Tenet-like grosses for a year or two or a couple of years here for most big Hollywood productions, then you're basically writing off the U.S. box office completely, which granted, it doesn't really exist right now. But even, I mean, you know, so go back and look at Christopher Nolan's last couple of films and what kind of business they did in the United States. Interstellar and Dunkirk both made about $188 million domestically. Inception made closer to $300 million domestically. That's a huge amount of money that studios would be saying, well, we're going to assume that we won't be bringing in that amount of revenue, and maybe we'll be able to increase the foreign box office a little bit. Although in this environment, I actually think that you're still probably looking at somewhat depressed foreign box office relative to what you would have pre-COVID. And yeah, that's going to mean that literally the only things that they can produce are really safe sequels that are going to play very broadly and be completely uninteresting, because the only things that are going to be able to justify the 150 million plus, you know, production budgets that we see now for big Hollywood movies, and the only thing that's going to be able to justify that sort of international only global release that we're talking about here are just super, super safe franchise films done on large but not quite gigantic budgets. And that's in some ways, that's the world we were, you know, heading towards anyway. But this would radically accelerate it. On the other hand, you know, well, we can talk about this somewhat later. The streaming world right now is imperfect and frustrating, but also kind of interesting in that it is supporting a bunch of movies and the types of movies that might not exist in a, you know, in a, or that don't exist, you know, theatrically at all right now, and that are, you know, kind of smaller budget, more interesting films. You can look at things like the new Sofia Coppola film, you know, just there's a bunch of kind of smaller films that are getting financed and picked up through the streaming services, the Aaron Sorkin Chicago Trial, the Chicago Seven, that sort of thing, which was scheduled for release. And, you know, maybe the world that we are heading towards is studios produce very bland blockbusters for the international market. Americans can enjoy them if they want. And then Americans get, you know, interesting, weirder stuff on the streaming services that right now are in an experimental phase that is actually producing a lot of weirdly notable material.
I think it's, just going to say, it's worth noting what you said about a cash crunch. I mean, the studios just have less money coming in. The theaters are desperately raising money through, you know, they're trying, like, taking on debt, trying to stay afloat. But there's literally just going to be less money sloshing around to make movies. I mean, there are questions about how long
marginal products are the interesting products, the risky ones are the ones that get slashed first.
Yeah. And I mean, there are the logistical challenges of producing anything, though it definitely seems like European shoots are continuing even with the big second wave there. But there's literally just less cash. I mean, Netflix just raised subscription prices some, but it's not clear how long they're going to be able to keep spending the way that they've been spending. And so, yeah, there's literally less money available to make movies.
Yeah, I mean, this is part of the problem with counting on the streamers picking up the weirder stuff, the smaller stuff idea, right? Because On the Rocks was made for theatrical release. On the Rocks was not a movie that was made
Streamers. Chicago 7, that's true.
Trial of the Chicago 7. Netflix original
for
Paramount
theatrical release, and then Netflix picked it up sometime over the summer and put it out on their service exclusively.
Sure. And then you get Amazon picking up the new Borat movie, which was supposed to go in theaters, obviously did not. But my point is that a lot of this stuff was made with the intention of going to theaters. I don't know that a lot of it can be made without that promise of domestic box office revenue. And as Alyssa notes, Netflix is essentially still just burning cash. Netflix is still just ripping through debt and accumulating debt and lighting Joker pyramid of cash size amounts of money on fire every month or so. I mean, it is spending an incredible amount of money and is not sustainable. Frankly, it's just not sustainable. But that brings us to Netflix, which you know, there have been an interesting series of stories suggesting that Netflix is engaging in a bit of buyer's remorse over their mega deals with producers like Ryan Murphy and Shonda Rhimes. And I'm kind of curious what you guys make of this. It's interesting to me because I don't really watch a lot of Netflix's TV stuff. I find it, I don't have time for it, first of all. And the time crunch that comes with trying to watch a whole season in a week so I can talk about it with everybody is just really draining. I just don't have time for it. Which leads me to focus on their movies, and their movies seem to be getting trounced by other things in the marketplace right now. I mean, there was an interesting little poll of data that came from, I frankly, a source that I don't entirely trust, but Variety published it, so I'll give it a little bit of credence. But Variety suggests that, look, you know, the top three movies that have been released in SVOD in 2020 are Hamilton, Borat 2, and My Spy. Those are three movies that have nothing that were not on Netflix at all. Two were Prime Video, one was Disney Plus. And if you look at the top 10, number four is Extraction. So Netflix's biggest movie hit so far this year, according to this this data, is Extraction. Number five is another Disney Plus movie. It's Phineas and Ferb, the movie. Number six is Mulan, and Mulan, frankly, got downgraded a bit because people had to pay extra money to watch it. But it's still, according to this data, the sixth most streamed movie of the year. Then you have two more Netflix movies, The Old Guard Trial of Chicago 7, and then number nine is Roald Dahl's The Witches. Number 10 was The Lovebirds. So you look at this list and you have Netflix, which is the biggest streamer in the world, the biggest, has the most subscribers by far. It is in many, many households, many, many more households than Disney Plus, many, many more households than Prime Video or HBO Max or Hulu. And what do we see? We see Netflix still can't dominate this list. And if they can't dominate it right now, I don't see how they're supposed to be able to dominate it and raise the sort of money that they need to keep burning this giant pyramid of cash every couple months going forward. Am I wrong? What am I missing?
Not to
here?
Go completely Marshall McLuhan on you, but I think there's just a medium question here, which is that a world of filmed entertainment that is dominated by at-home streaming services is probably going to be a world in which serialized, episodic, long-form storytelling dominates rather than self-contained two-hour or so features. In the same way that short stories, which used to be just like a dominant form of storytelling in America, kind of gave way to television, movies, that sort of thing in the post-war era, and now are just sort of like a hobbyist thing. Yes, people still write short stories, but there's no giant market for them. Nobody's getting rich off of them. I mean, every once in a while, you get somebody who writes one that pops and you get a book deal out of it. But even still, it's a pretty niche product. The
cat right, people.
Yes, that's exactly what I'm thinking of. But it's still a relatively niche product, and a world in which we get most of our filmed entertainment through streaming services that aren't there to bring you to a specific product, but instead are there to bring you to a platform that offers a suite of products and just wants you to pay a monthly subscription fee for access. What they want is just to sort of have stuff that you're generally interested in watching in or vaguely interested in watching at any point. And that's going to be the television, right? And episodic television. The other thing is, though, you know, anyway, and just to sort of one more point on that is that is the HBO model. That's the FX model. I mean, HBO does produce some good features every now and then. But what is HBO known for? They're a cable network. They're known for their television shows, FX as well. And so they do, even when they're doing miniseries, it's still, here's 4, 5, 6 episodes. It's not, let's do a single self-contained feature that can be watched in a single viewing. And I think that the streaming format just supports long-form episodic kind of sprawly storytelling much better than it supports feature filmmaking. And the theatrical experience, of course, doesn't support serialized storytelling nearly as well, even though Marvel has kind of experimented with that. The other thing, though, is, and we've talked about this before, is Netflix has a lot of money and actually quite a bit of real top-tier talent. What they do not appear to have is a development process for taking quite talented filmmakers and making sure that their interesting ideas turn out to really exceptionally good products.
Well, and I think that Sonny, go ahead.
Yeah, Alyssa, before we get to that, and I do think that is very key, and I want to talk about that. But what one thing I am curious about here, Alyssa, is the Netflix model for releasing TV show sustainable, right? So their big innovation was, we're putting out 10 hours of a show on one day, and you binge it for the weekend, and then in 3 weeks we'll put out another thing that you have to watch 10 hours. Now, I obviously this has worked for them. Netflix continues to dominate the Nielsen ratings of TV shows, right, on streaming. They continue to be 8 or 9 of the top 10 generally options there. But What I think we have seen with both The Boys and The Mandalorian, which is now in its second season, is that a weekly release strategy keeps you in the conversation longer, and it makes you have to spend less money. I mean, this is the thing, right? HBO, the HBO model, Peter, right, is based on HBO making 5 or 6 great shows that essentially run one night a week for you know 10 weeks, and then that covers
although
their whole year.
HBO is expanding the number of productions that they're doing and putting some of it directly on HBO Max.
Right. But I mean, so Alyssa, do you think this is where I think the big change is coming that nobody is really talking about, is that I question whether or not the Netflix model is sustainable, not in terms of how much money they are spending, though it is tied to this, but just in terms of their release strategy. Because if you do this, if you keep doing this, you're going to keep burning through cash. It's just not sustainable.
And also, I mean, this has become something of a hobby horse of mine, but I think that what is sacrificed in Netflix's sort of give you everything exactly when you want it model is a sense of cultural connection. And I think Netflix has hugely fed into the atomization of the conversation around television shows. And look, I mean, I loved watching Game of Thrones for 8 years, but you know what I really loved for 8 years was talking to other people about Game of Thrones and being able to have a sustained, detailed, evolving conversation about each episode as it came out. The Netflix model makes that completely impossible. And you see things like Netflix Party that let people, watch episodes together synced up in real time, but it is just no replacement for a large scale cultural conversation around a smaller number of things. That, you know, that's fun. The social element is part of it. That structure is, you know, good for the television shows themselves because they have time to sort of roll out in longer seasons. You can course correct, you know, if you're on a network television show, if something's not quite working. But also people just have the time to watch the stuff and discuss it. And I mean, I don't like watching Netflix shows very much because I never feel like I have anyone to discuss them with. They're hard to write about from a cultural perspective because you don't know what counts as a spoiler for people at any given time. You have no idea when people want the discussions of various big plot twists. I mean, it's culturally atomizing. It's lonely. It's a less fun way to watch TV, irrespective of how good the TV is or isn't. Yeah, but in terms of Netflix's development process, you know, the big promise when Netflix started signing deals with people like Ryan Murphy, who has produced, I think, the most content on his deal of any of the people they locked down with a mega contract, was sort of total artistic freedom, that you were going to get the totally unfiltered Ryan Murphy or Kenyon Barris or Shonda Rhimes. And it turns out, again, we have the most content from Murphy to judge. I think the extent to which most people like the totally unfiltered Ryan Murphy is like kind of questionable. You've had him pursuing a bunch of sort of weird passion projects that are often kind of sour, very much informed by his sort of private obsessions, and are not striking big in the way that something like Glee, which was like relatively family friendly, or even American Horror Story has. And, you know, Netflix has money, but it does not appear to have a consistent sense of taste. I don't know if either of you listen to Karina Longworth's podcast. You must remember this, but she just finished up a season about Polly Platt, who was sort of first a production designer and then an executive producer working with her then husband, Peter Bogdanovich, then James L. Brooks. She was someone who incubated sort of Wes Anderson, helped make The Simpsons happen. And, you know, her career, even if, you know, she wasn't as famous or as sort of recognized as she possibly deserved to be during her life, is a testament to the power of good, consistent taste. And that is idiosyncratic. You can measure popularity with an algorithm, but you cannot reverse engineer it. You cannot reverse engineer taste from data. And, you know, one of the things you see, HBO was very good because you had a sort of strong sense of taste and development process. FX is successful, and probably the most successful of the basic cablers, because John Landgraf, who's the head of that network, is both very smart about data and trend spotting, but he has good taste and a good, you know, sort of range of taste, from pulpier stuff like the Kurt Sutter shows to the sort of more refined stuff like Mrs. America and Fosse Verdon.
And it's not just that he has good taste. It's that he clearly has a good sense of how to work with creators to help.
Including difficult ones. Yes.
And creators like working with him because they know that he's not there to tell them to go stuff themselves and your ideas are stupid. What he's there to do is say, this is a good idea. Let's make it better and more accessible.
Not to subtweet one of the big stories in the political and media world, but it turns out editing is good.
I mean, I think this is actually something that all of us share. We've talked about this before, is that all of us, in addition to writing, have done work as editors, and even very good writers who are just exceptionally talented people frequently, in most cases, benefit from having somebody else there to kind of bounce their ideas off of, to workshop things, to sharpen their ideas. And writing is you know, very much a kind of solo activity in a lot of ways, but having that extra person there whose job is not to produce it, but to think about what should be done and sort of how to maintain a consistent sense of quality and a sensibility is a valuable thing in journalism, in television, in all kinds of storytelling and creative endeavors.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I do think that there is a scale problem here as well, right? Which kind of gets back to our point about budgets and how big they should be and what will get made. Like, a movie like The Wolf of Snow Hollow, which I liked a lot, is very much a product of an individual creator's, like, I'm going to make this movie, and it's going to be, you know, $1 million, and it's going to be huge by my standards, but still very small by everybody else's standards, is doable. I think you can get away with that. I think when you have a guy like Ryan Murphy pouring tens and tens of millions of dollars into these just deeply weird and as Alyssa says, just kind of sour projects, you run into a very, very real problem. Or say, if you give Christopher Nolan $200 million and you say, you can do anything you want with time, you end up with a movie like Tenet, where the last, I don't know, half hour or so is almost incomprehensible. Which, you know, again, there are pluses and minuses. There are pluses and minuses. And I like to see big swings even when they miss. But we are talking about pluses and minuses. Alyssa, what do you make of the new Shonda Rhimes project? I mean, you said that you had mentioned it in a chat with us.
Yeah, so this is a slightly embarrassing story I'm going to tell about myself, but I have really terrible nightmares. I always have since I'm a child. I have a hard time waking up from them. And when I was in college, my sophomore year roommate, Denise Levitan, go Denise, got so sick of these nightmares that she started just handing me romance novels whenever I had one, so I could have something to like distract my brain and go back to sleep. And the ones that she kept handing me were this series by the author Julia Quinn, who writes about an extended family in Regency England through the Bridgerton romances, and Rhimes is adapting them. And so the minute those things showed up in my Netflix queue, you better believe that I distracted myself from the election season by watching them. The two of you would hate this. I mean, it's a straight up romance novel show. It's like, you know, super corny, lot of boning in the later episodes. It's basically mommy porn. I enjoyed the heck out of it, but I would put down $20 that it ends up being one of the most controversial shows of the year, in part because it is going to land in the middle of the Hollywood diversity debate in some really strange ways. And so of the shows that have come out of these sort of creator mega deals, and I should note, this is not actually show run by Shonda Rhimes herself. It's under her production banner, but it's not a show that she is like writing and directing. Someone else is doing that. And so it is in many ways a really good encapsulation of her vision. It's like tweaked from the novels in certain ways that kind of amp up the tension for Netflix's purpose, but it's a pretty faithful encapsulation of both these novels, which are quite popular, and of Rhimes' aesthetic. But because she has done certain things around race in the show, I think it is going to land in a way that is jarring to some viewers. And so paradoxically, even though it's like exactly the thing that Netflix hired Shonda Rhimes to do, I think I would just keep an eye on this one, because I think the debates around it are going to be really interesting, in as much as it's even possible to have a debate about anything on Netflix.
Yeah. I mean, this is the real question for me is, right, like, can it be the most controversial show of the year if nobody's really watching and talking about it? I mean, I don't know. I have no good sense of how many people are actually watching this thing, or how big a hit it is or isn't. So I don't know. It is as with everything else. Netflix somewhere now, I'm though, kind of lost.
Without a box office to speak of, and without even really dominant kind of television shows in the mold of Game of Thrones. Yes, people have been watching Lovecraft Country. You know, there've been a few shows that have gotten more attention, relatively speaking, but there are no single products that appear to be dominating kind of cultural conversation. And you know, the kind of critic, arguments that were common even a year ago. Instead, it's just sort of people casting about, watching whatever it is they happen to be watching, writing about stuff, and it's sort of echoing out into the valley, and you're not quite sure if anybody's listening. And it's just a really weird moment right now in which it's very hard to tell what anybody's watching on any network.
Yeah.
At all, right? Netflix is part of the problem and maybe sort of the origin of the problem, but not the end of it.
Interesting about the variety list you sent us, Sunny, and that we were talking about earlier in the podcast is that it ranks, you know, what movies are theoretically most popular on the streaming services, but we have no idea what popular means, right? I mean,
yeah,
you know, Apple TV Plus has never released its subscriber numbers. We have no idea how many people are actually paying for that service or just surfing on free subscriptions. You know, we know that Disney Plus has a pretty strong subscriber base, stronger than they had initially forecast, but we don't know how many people rented Mulan on its premium video on demand because they wouldn't release the numbers. All the metrics are nonsense. And to a certain extent, it's a good thing for pop culture to be freed from the tyranny, like this sort of overwhelming tyranny of like what constitutes a hit. It's been, you know, a lot of shows have stayed alive on network television because the ratings thresholds for what counts as a successful show have gotten lower over time. But it's kind of weird not to know what's popular at all. I feel just totally adrift about it. It's very strange.
And this brings me to kind of the final thing I wanted to discuss, which is that what is most popular, the thing that is most popular and has been for several years now, is the Donald Trump show, right? The thing, this is absolutely consumed the culture in very real ways, that all focus is kind of poured into, oh, what crazy thing is Donald Trump doing now? Oh, what slide towards authoritarian fascism are we enduring at this point? And this has affected cultural writing in deeply negative ways. I think there is an obsession with Trump that kind of comes through and is bad for the discussion of movies. Like I don't want to suggest that I'm, you know, saying critics should shut up and write about the movies, right? It's not a shut up and play ball situation, but it is a function, I think, of what we are discussing here, right? Which is that there is no common cultural thing. There is no big show. There is no big movie. And this problem has been exacerbated horribly in the last 10 months or so as the coronavirus epidemic has raged and the theaters have shut down and we're all kind of stuck at home and just watching news and TV, right? And as a result, everybody focuses on the presidency to the point where, and this, I find this really funny. I don't know if you guys do, but I found it really funny that RogerEbert.com, for the first time in their history, they made a big deal of this, the first time in their history, they're endorsing a president. And I, for one, was shocked. I thought it was going to be a real close thing. But the film critics, they wanted Donald Trump out of office. They wanted Joe Biden to win. I was blown away by this. But I can't help but feel like I would say that like 80% of the reason why I want Trump gone is so we can get back to just talking about cultural stuff and not have it be totally inflected by him and his nonsense.
Yeah.
No. Right. I mean, this is a thing we have discussed privately, and I don't want to get too much into our private discussions, but I do feel like that there is a he has had a deleterious effect on the mental well-being of many of our colleagues, including us, frankly. I wouldn't exclude us from that. And I think him being gone will be good for the state of the cultural conversation, just in general, just the actual discussion of movies.
There was a tweet that went around, I think on Tuesday, on election day, about a voter in Florida, I believe, who had come in to the polls intending to vote for Donald Trump and then changed his, I believe his, it might have been a woman, changed their mind at the polls because, and the reason they gave to the reporter who they were talking to was, you know, I just want things to go back to normal. I'm tired of my Instagram feed being all politics. I want it to be selfies. Right. And it was marked in a certain way, but it also completely reasonable that someone didn't want all of the cultural conversation and like all public discussion of like what it means to be an American or a person alive in 2020 to be dominated by one idiot politician with bad hair in the White House.
Yeah, no. And I come to this conversation as someone who, when I started working professionally as a critic about 10 years ago, was kind of a lonely voice in looking at the politics of culture. My first time at the Television Critics Association press tour, I asked some questions to executives about diversity and what they were greenlighting and got made fun of on Twitter by other critics. And now those questions are totally mainstream. And
so this is all your fault, is what 100%. You're saying.
I mean, everything.
The diversity obsession.
Everything is Alyssa all Rosenberg's fault. And I would say, you know, 10 years in, I believe and have always believed that culture does political work. And this is not, you know, this is not a lone or weird lefty opinion. It's, you know, it was an animating idea for Andrew Breitbart, who was a major conservative media entrepreneur. But I think where I differ from some of my colleagues is that I believe that the political work that art has to do is distinct from the work that is performed by political parties or by elected officials. And I think the role that art plays most effectively and, you know, does most importantly in our democracy is to speak aloud ideas that are verboten or unspeakable or don't have a particular place in our political system, and to imagine things that are not seen as comprehensible or feasible in the contours of our political system. One of the reasons that I love Zero Dark Thirty, which I think is an absolute masterpiece of a movie, is that it
objectively glorifies torture?
Yes. Speaking of people who need editors, hopefully Glenn's listening.
Is that it is a movie that takes this moment of American catharsis and makes it exhausting, turns it upside down, focuses on the sort of drain and the anti-climax of the experience. And that is not something that was sayable, that had room in the discourse at the time Osama bin Laden was killed, but it is really useful for someone to have said it. And I think that we are culturally and politically having a hard time discussing that kind of distinct role for the arts in expanding our conversations. And I think that's really unfortunate. I like art that is politically uncompliant and unruly and that makes me feel weird and question my priors in multiple directions. And I hope that if Trump is defeated, as we are taping this podcast, we're like probably a couple hours away from having results in Georgia, that maybe that conversation, that distinct role can be more elevated in the conversation, because I think that would be politically and artistically healthy.
I think what you're getting at here is a difference that has become, I think, almost unbearable in the last few years, which is art is not being judged by the ideas so much as how it plays on a partisan level, right? Like it's one thing for the arts to be largely liberal and progressive, right? And it's another thing for them to be team Democrat all the time. And that I think is I think a thing that has changed in the Trump era, or at least has become more vocalized in the Trump era, right? Like, this is why I was kind of joking about the Roger Ebert endorsement, right? I don't think anybody is surprised that the site would endorse a Democrat. I don't think there was any question there. But and that's not a good or bad thing. It's just like, okay, obviously. It's like, we know. I will be happy when RogerEbert.com goes back to not feeling that they have like some sort of moral need to weigh in and say, okay, well, this is the person you should elect.
There's this mistaken sense amongst both critics and to some extent creators and the producers who, you know, sort of edit and purchase their work right now, that any art that isn't affirmatively doing the work of being anti-Trump is insufficient in some way. And it needs to be clearly and unambiguously stating political priors. And, you know, it's not quite the inciting
partisan, again, partisan priors, like not clearly and firmly stating like we believe in equality or we believe in it's like you we believe in electing Democratic officials to office and getting rid of the bum in the White House.
And it leads to criticism that's boring, predictable, and I think worst of all, simple. Right. Like the interesting thing about like movies and stories and art that's interesting, it's timeless and it's interesting because it's complex, because it resists easy interpretation, because virtually all of my favorite movies, like you can say some things that they kind of clearly say about the world, but there's also something prismatic about them. Right. Different people come to them and see different things. And every time you watch them, you see it in a different light and it reflects differently off of the time you're living in. If you watch it in 2005 versus in 2015 or 2020 and criticism and art that like doesn't want to engage on that level, I think is just not very useful and not very interesting. And is like, that's not the point of that's not what I want art to be about. It's not what I want criticism to be about. And I would say that, you know, it's not quite the origin story here. It's not quite the inciting incident, but it was really notable back in, I think it was 2017, when Michiko Kukutani, who was the most powerful book critic in the world for like 20 years. I mean, she was just, it was her and Oprah, right? And just, and in terms of actual critics whose job was to read books and write about them perceptively, no one was more powerful. James Wood might have been maybe more respected in the, you know, critical world. And she ended up leaving the Times and taking a buyout in part because she wanted to write a political column and they wouldn't let her. And oh my goodness, she had a job reading novels and describing them to millions of
and
readers.
Making or breaking them.
Pretty well for
making
it.
Or breaking
that's
them.
That's crazy that you would like, then decide that what you really want to do is write about the filibuster.
Yeah, I mean, this is your wife, Peter, Megan McArdle, had a very incisive tweet, I thought, a week or two back, which, and this
is
I'm just going to read it
columnist.
Because I love it.
There is nothing wrong with being a political columnist. All three There's of us no,
right,
have
right,
worked
no, nothing,
as political
nothing wrong
opinion
with.
Journalists, continue to
Absolutely.
In some ways. But it just sort of seems crazy to me that you would want to step off of the, you know, out of the world of books and art and that sort of idea and into a sort of rough and tumble day-to-day political argument.
But also boring. But I mean, this is what Megan tweeted, right? The strangest development of the last 5 years or so is that all of the movie and arts and food writers seem to want to do is talk politics, while all the politics people I know just want to talk about music and television and food. And I think there's something very true there, right? There's this idea that like that the political people need a release from the grind of like doing nothing but politics all the time, and the arts writers feel that what they are doing is not important enough, so they need to really like get into the nitty-gritty of the political. And this is what you just described, the New York Times book critic leaving, it blew my mind. It just absolutely blew my mind. I was like, I can't imagine, as you say, Peter, wanting to like go write about the filibuster instead of like making or breaking the entire world of novels and fiction.
Well, and I think that I'd make sort of two adjacent points. The first is that, look, the Donald Trump's election was politically galvanizing for a lot of people, including a lot of liberal critics. And I think it was galvanizing for a lot of people who were liberal but not radicalized in some way. Critics are probably overrepresented in that category, so it makes sense that those effects would be felt particularly strongly in those spaces. And in some cases, I do think that those reckonings are long-term going to make for healthier criticism. For example, you know, and I have written about this extensively, you know, cop shows have been one of the most dominant and sort of under-interrogated tropes in American popular culture. And they have been sort of consumed in some fairly predictable ways. They're just sort of an accepted feature of the landscape. And seeing long-term critics like Alan Sepinwall, who, you know, to a certain extent, like kind of made his bones writing about cop shows, kind of interrogate that and see people thinking about a part of the landscape that they just took for granted get shook up, I think that's going to make more interesting cop shows, more interesting writing about cop shows. And I'm excited to see where that comes down. I think that's a healthy thing. And I think that may end up being artistically and critically productive. And then there was something else I was going to say, and my brain is so fried by the election.
I mean, I think there's actually,
I
take your point, and I think you can make a hopeful case that if Trump is out of the picture, as seems likely, that critics will end up being politically informed without being partisan, obsessed with partisanship in a way that they maybe have been for the last couple of years.
And the other thing I would say is, you know, we've sort of joked about the Trump show being the kind of dominant, like that's the most popular show. And part of why it's a bummer to see critics move into sort of writing about politics in sort of horse racy or moralistic terms is that the tools of criticism are actually really useful to understanding and explaining what's going on to people right now. And bringing something distinct, bringing the ability to, you know, analyze a monologue or the stagecraft of a debate or, you know, the contradiction between, or, you know, the what people get out of Trump rallies, like bringing the tools of criticism to that in sort of an explanatory, investigative way is really useful to explaining what's going on right now. And critics should not give up those sort of distinct tools to explain the world that we live in.
In college, my English major was, my emphasis was in theater as text, so not theater as performance, but just as text. And so, of course, we read a bunch of like mid-century commie playwrights, and there's this whole like Bertolt Brecht shtick about how theater should sort of ideally take the form of two lawyers arguing on stage, and at the end the audience should move to action. It's literally, theater should be, you know, kind of it should be a sort of political statement that is designed to move the audience into a sort of not just a belief, but a belief that is followed by changing what they do. And you can argue with that as like a theory or whatever, but it's actually a super useful way of thinking about how politics works, and sort of being able to bring some of those tools of dramatic analysis that I learned in a mostly apolitical setting in college to political writing has always been pretty useful. And like, you know, and I do think that, you know, to be clear, like we've kind of crapped on critics and their political activism here, but there is a place for moving back and forth and for kind of blending those two worlds.
Yeah.
It's just that when you're a critic and all you want to do is sort of is simplify things and reduce everything to, is this affirmatively for the kind of a very like narrow political change that I favor this year, then it just becomes so boring.
I want to stop crapping on critics myself. I would like to give a special shout out to James Poniewozik. I don't know if I'm pronouncing his last name right. I just know Poniewozik. Thank you, Alyssa. Audience of One, which was a very good look at like Trump as kind of cultural phenomenon, using some of the, he's a TV critic at the New York Times, and he's very, very good at what he does. And he uses those tools of criticism to kind of look at the whole Trump thing in an interesting way.
I mean, critics are better positioned than almost anyone in American life to explain why Donald Trump is successful and appealing. And if you let the sort of visceral horror of his politics and his, you know, his personal conduct and the way he talks about the world overwhelm your ability to explain that, then something is getting lost. I mean, I find Donald Trump completely repulsive, but I also think he's an incredibly talented performer. And, you know, a lot of what people want out of politics is to be entertained. I wish that were not true, but given that it's a fact on the ground, critics have more power to explain this clearly and succinctly. And even if you think that Trump is horrifying and inexplicable, explaining clearly how he works and why he's appealing is one of the keys to defeating him. So you give up political power when you talk about politics in mundane terms, rather than preserving the power that you can have as a critic and a student of culture by using the distinct skills that you have gained in that sphere.
Yeah. I think that's a good ending point. Thank you very much for joining me on The Bulwark Goes to Hollywood, Alyssa and Peter. This was fun. Calls back another show. We were trying to figure out how to bring that back. We'll
keep you posted,
in touch there. Until then, please enjoy The Bulwark Goes to Hollywood. I am Sunny Bunch. I will be back next week with another episode.
At Ability Chiropractic, we believe every child deserves to grow up healthy, strong, and connected to the incredible power within their own body. From infants to adults, our doctors specialize in purposeful chiropractic care that restores balance between the brain and body, helping you and your family live and heal the way you were designed to, naturally. Families across Columbus are choosing to build lifelong wellness from the start. Discover what true health feels like at Ability Chiropractic. Schedule your visit today at abilitychiro.com.
Coda just made riding the bus easier than ever. Now you can pay your Coda fare by tapping your smartphone, smartwatch, or card, just like you do at the coffee shop or grocery store. Love paying with smart card? Keep doing that. Have a pass? Still works perfectly. Want to tap your phone? Now you can do that too. It's just one more way to move your way with Coda. Get moving now with Tap to Pay. Learn more at coda.com/tap.
Hello, it is Ryan, and we could all use an extra bright spot in our day, couldn't we? Just to make up for things like sitting in traffic, doing the dishes, counting your steps, you know, all the mundane stuff. That is why I'm such a big fan of Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has all your favorite social casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere with daily bonuses. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com. That's chumbacasino.com.
VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.